Hi, I'm Candace Michelle, and you're listening to another episode of Our Community. You know, since the beginning of January, when the port commissioners fired, then rehired, and put the port manager, Gary Dellinger, on administrative leave, there's been a lot of questions raised. A lot raised, and not many answered. In light of the pending lawsuits by Mr. Dellinger following his final firing on March 12th, and the recall petitions being circulated for four of the five port commissioners, the commissioners aren't talking. Trying to figure out what happened and why is trying to unravel a tangled skein of yarn. For the past few weeks, we've been talking with both Skylar Windham, a former port employee who initiated the recall petitions, and Jim Relaford, former port commissioner, who to try to understand some of the history of the port and how we got to this point. Today, Jim is here with us again, and we're joined by Ted Fitzgerald, longtime resident and former port manager. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Thank you.
So nice to have you both here. So things just keep getting more interesting down at the Port of Brookings Harbor. But before we get into all of that, Ted, I wanted to say I'm sorry to hear about your mother's recent passing. She's been a cornerstone in this community for a long time, and I'm sure she will be greatly missed.
She will be missed, and especially by me, but thank you.
Yeah, I know. When I lost my mother, it's a blow. I mean, it just is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit about yourself? You know, were you born here? Were you raised here? What's the deal
with
you?
When I moved to Brookings with my family when I was 6 years old. My parents bought a ranch north of town, about 10 miles north of town. So I'm actually not a Brookings resident.
You weren't actually born here.
I was not born here. I was born like so many others in California.
Yeah.
But so, I was...
You're a transplant.
Yeah, we lived up in Carpenterville, and I've basically lived in the community with short trips elsewhere. You know, I lived here and there for a year or two. I went to law school in San Francisco, went to undergraduate in Portland, lived in England for a year.
Oh, wow.
Did some different things like that. But I've been back here and practicing law since 1995, and working on my ranch and doing a variety of different things. And in those days, it was a pretty little town back when I grew up. And it's changed a lot in a lot of ways. But of course, we still have the river and we still have the ocean. We still have the mountains. We have everything that makes us want to live here.
But when you say it was a little town, like how many folks? So the city of Brookings right now is like 6,500 people. The county's probably 20,000 or so.
For a long time, it seems like the sign said something like 7,000. It got bigger.
It got bigger. Because of the mills and stuff.
Well,
right?
At that time, we had three mills in town. We had Agnew, South Coast, Brookings Plywood. And those have all been combined into one ownership and basically, you know, less actual sawmills now.
Okay.
And the ownership structure was different. But, and also in those days, logging was more people intensive.
Right.
And so you've ended up, you know, same thing working in the mills too. They've automated a lot of that stuff. So you can get by with less people now than what it took to support the place earlier. But in those days, most everybody was either a logger, a mill worker, or a fisherman.
Wow.
So
the town must have felt different, right? If that was the makeup of the people.
Oh, yeah.
Not a lot of tourist places.
Well, this has been a hard place to get to for a long time. So it wasn't as touristy then as it is now. And we had, in those days they had, when I was a kid, I remember my fondest goal was to sneak into the Green Door, which was a tavern.
I've heard about the Green Door.
I did. For some reason, I was looking back, I did go there for lunch. When I'd sneak off out of Azalea, I'd come down and have lunch at the bar at the Green Door.
Interesting.
And I'd look back and there'd be a bunch of loggers back there having lunch and usually starting with a few drinks, and things would get a little wild even then. So it was an exciting, it was kind of a different approach.
You know, people flying out the door, fist fights in the middle of the street.
It was a wild place, but then it burned down as places like that usually do, you know. So, but things change over the years, you know. Ken's Tavern changed, you're closed eventually.
Right.
And those were, it's kind of hard to look back and think that really the biggest noteworthies of the town were the taverns, but really they kind of were. A lot happened in them.
I think that's actually kind of pretty funny.
And that, well, it was just a logging town. And it was, you know, in the 60s, especially, I was only, you know, I we moved here in 69, so I mostly just heard stories. But in the 60s, this is a pretty, it was a rocking and rolling place.
Wow.
So at any rate, that's how I grew up on a sheep ranch up north of town. So I didn't get into town as much as I could because I had no way to get here. But, you know, things have changed a little bit. And since then, you know, I was working as an attorney, and I was approached by the Port Commission when they had, I know this is going to be a shock, they had wrongfully terminated their executive director. And
deja vu all over again.
And we're without an acting executive director. I think Roy Davis was filling in as interim at that point, but he was a commissioner and didn't work to keep him.
So who was the director that was?
His name was Richard Drehobel.
Okay.
And
okay.
So at any rate, that's how I got associated with him. I came in to kind of I just worked as a consultant for several years up until 2011, I think. From 2000 end of 2008 to through 2011, I worked as a consultant and kind of helped him balance the books and work on some of their issues. And we also working with Jim Relaford here and with a guy named John Barton, who is a financial consultant that was brought in by the port. He's out of Coos Bay. We did a workout on that $6 million worth of debt. I basically agreed to help the port when I found out that the state at that time was foreclosing on the debt for non-payment. So,
and that was that whole thing where Russ was going to probably convert it into...
This was just right after he was gone.
Okay.
There were two executive directors after Russ, mm-hmm. prior to Ted.
Okay.
Dave Scott was hired immediately when mm-hmm. Russ was gone. And then after Scott was then Rich Drehobel. Okay. And then Ted.
Okay. So you came on board, hopefully, to kind of fix that financial...
Yes.
...weirdness that was happening.
Yes. So we did a workout with the state.
Was the state really going to foreclose?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, they were... Well, I mean... We had a letter saying that they were foreclosing on the debt. And
what would that have meant?
That would have meant that the state had a blanket lien on all of the real property of the port. And the state, in order to satisfy its debt, would have two choices. You could argue with me on this, Jim, if you want, but as far as I can see, either they would come in and take over the operation of the port, which would be not economically advisable for the state of Oregon to do.
I can't imagine they would want to do that.
Or they could sell real property to satisfy the debt.
Wow.
And so both of those things were things that
the state has a history of doing both.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Coos Bay, they actually came in and replaced the commission. Just replaced the commission, replaced
really?
The employees, hired
wow.
a manager and went forward. In other places, they've sold assets to satisfy the debt.
Because I would think that they would not want to be involved in
it. No, they wouldn't. They really didn't want to sell assets. They don't want to foreclose. They want to help you any way they can, generally.
But you got to be able to give them some money. You've
got to be straightforward with them.
Okay, so you came in, and hopefully we're going to fix things up.
Well, we of the $6 million, it was about $6 million at that point. We paid down during my time with the port. We paid down about $2 million worth of that debt.
And how over how many years was that?
That was 8 years.
Okay.
About eight.
Okay.
And so we paid down $2 million worth of debt. So we had about $3.5 million roughly in there.
That's
like
real
that.
Good.
It was really good. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It was great. We developed a plan with the state. We stuck to it. Now, there was a little intervening adventure.
I love it.
Called the tsunami of 2011,
yes.
which did affect our ability to make payments mm-hmm. on a timely basis. We missed a total of, I want to say, either four or six payments. I think it was six payments between 2011 and May of 2014 when it was finally when all construction was finished and the thing was back up and running.
But that's not hideous.
Well, we did have a letter from Governor Kitzhaber that Jim Relaford had written a letter to him and brought this to his attention the moment the tsunami happened. Governor Kitzhaber did write us a letter and excused us from making payments.
Oh,
during that time. So, but we still made the majority of the payments in any event, which was lucky because then when Kitzhaber was no longer there, the state came in and said, you need to catch up on those payments. And they're basically $62,500 a quarter. Okay. And so they wanted to know how to, you know, they wanted us to increase our payments to them so they'd get paid off and get caught up. And the reality of it was that with the port in the condition it is, most of the operations, most of the money, the revenue generated from operations needs to go to maintenance and upkeep on the place. And that's what we were doing. We you know, the paying down of the debt was actually minor compared to what we did to address a lot of the long-term issues that have plagued the port and still do plague them. You know, there things appear at the port and you have to respond to them because a lot of the way that it was built throughout the years, the original design was great. I think the original build out was great, but that was a long time ago. And a lot of the stuff that's been done since then was done patchwork, done by people who weren't qualified to do heavy construction. And you end up with things like sinkholes in the parking lot. You end up with broken water lines because instead of schedule 40, they thought they'd get away with schedule 80 and put it 2 inches deep instead of 2 feet deep.
Oh my word.
these are all things that happen on an almost daily basis. And that's where, whenever you think you're getting ahead, there's another emergency. And so that's, so we were always playing catch up, but we were doing it. Also, you have unlooked for things like boats sinking and just the operation of the port results in expenditure. You know, when I first got there, no one was required to have insurance on their boats. So we had a lot of boats that were uninsured. And when they sank, the people walked away from them and they sank fairly regularly and people walked away from them. And then the port got to pay to float them and get them out and salvage them. And
what kind of a process is that? I mean, how do you get a boat up from the, if it's sunk?
Well, these are all trade secrets and I got to tell you.
Okay, then you'd have to kill me if you told me, okay.
All I can tell you is that we got real good at it.
Oh, good.
it's actually not that hard. You just have to get pumps on it. You have to get something under it. You got to get close enough. You got to have, it helps if you have commercial fishermen who are around that will help you, that have the tools that you don't. Like, for example, the last boat that sank during this last crab season, port staff was just about had it up above the water. They didn't quite have what it took. And Joe Spear came by in the Equinox, hooked it to his, I guess he hooked it to his crab block, lifted the tail end of the boat up out of the water high enough to get some air in there, problem solved. So, and by working with the, you know, having a cooperative attitude with the other fishermen, the other users of the port, we got a lot done. So, you know, those are all things that it's just hard to get ahead because historically that port has always been underfunded. It was organized by and for commercial fishermen and kind of operated by them. And that's not necessarily a recipe for success for the underlying entity because we tend to subsidize that industry at the expense of the infrastructure of the port. It looks like that's my takeaway having been there for 8 years. And also since then I've been engaged in the commercial fishing industry myself and I can see where they're coming from. I understand how it happened, but it doesn't make it a workable equation.
And how did that, weren't you telling me before that the port actually, they hand dug it out?
Well, back that, Jim would have to talk about that, but back before the boat basins were dug and before the river was dredged on a regular basis, they, you know, the river would silt in.
There's several photos of that.
Where they were digging it out by hand?
It's kind of like Pistol River. Mm-hmm. You know, during the summertime, late summer, you can't even see where the river hits the ocean.
Hmm.
Well, there's a salmon run that comes up the Pistol River.
Oh.
Which you have to dig the channel out so the salmon can get up there. Well, that's the way it was in the Chetco River as well.
Wow.
They had a spring run that could come up, but the fall run couldn't come up without... In fact, there are a lot of pictures of the guys out digging with their shovels.
With their shovels. Amazing.
And they dug out, they had some equipment. They didn't dig the basins out by hand, but you know, they were the port was dug out what 65 years ago.
Pretty long time ago.
Wow.
A long time ago, but a short time compared to a lot of places. Okay. Brookings is a fairly new community, you know. It's only incorporated, in 53?
Right.
So, but the port itself, all the infrastructure was wood.
Well, wood's not going to last.
All the basins.
All the pilings.
The whole thing, the pilings, everything was wood.
Right.
And unfortunately, we live in a beautiful community, but it's one that's destined to destroy you. The salt air will destroy wood sooner or later. And that's what was happening. The sport basin was becoming unusable completely. You could not walk out on the docks without taking your life in your hands because they're only about 2 feet wide to begin with and rotting. That's when I was telling you why we had to come up with $2.5 million and a way to pay for it to get new concrete docks in there. Mm-hmm. That's what that was replacing. And the next part of that process was going to be to replace that same thing in the commercial basin because there was a lot of wooden docks in the commercial basin. Mm-hmm. Mother Nature helped us out.
With the tsunami.
It destroyed all the old docks. So most of the docks... There's still some wooden docks, but not very many. I don't think.
About 75% of the docks in the commercial basin have all been replaced. Either replaced or port staff revamped them themselves.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Took them out and rebuilt them.
100% of the docks in the sport basin have been replaced.
Go ahead.
I was asking Ted earlier, because I was a little confused. I've read these stories about the pilings that have been in the ground only 4 feet deep.
Understand that.
Well, It's easier to understand now, at least for me. As I told you, how the funding happened, you know, when Russ was funding things, he'd basically come up with an idea, get a good design, get a plan for it, go find a loan for it, and then use about 75% of the approved monies. On that project, and the other 25% on the project that was behind that didn't get done.
Okay.
So the pilings that went in for the new sport basin that he put in were actually not enough steel to give 20 feet deep, and they were actually intentionally put in 5 feet deep.
So why?
Well, because he could use the money elsewhere. That sounds like a very bad thing, but I could understand what his thinking was. And what he was trying to do was to, first of all, keep employment up. I think I told you at one time the port had 41 employees when they were doing all this building. Secondly, he was trying to get the biggest bang for the dollar. And, you know, who knew that we were going to have a tsunami? Where all the shortcomings of a 5 foot deep piling would soon come to bear.
Very apparent, yes.
So, you know, but a lot of that, Candace, goes to my pet peeve, I guess, about this whole process that we're going through, that we're taking your time and we're taking a lot of people's time, and I don't see anything happening at the port. And part of the reason for that is that we're looking backwards. I've never seen a commission. I've been down here for over 20 years, 25 years, been through port commission after port commission. I have never once seen a commission, regardless of how vitriolic the election was, where the incoming administration spent time looking backward to try to do something for one reason or another with the prior administrations.
It's very confusing.
It makes no sense because if anybody thinks about it, you are coming into office at different times, different economic periods, a totally different set of circumstances. And it seems to me that that's part of the problem that we have right now is that we don't have a planning process and we're looking backward. We're looking for somebody to blame something on. Now, the only reason I can think that's the case is that we have some commissioners that have a personal agenda. And if you've got a personal agenda, you should not be running for a nonpartisan job that doesn't pay anything.
No, obviously
not. It makes no sense to do that.
Right.
we should be looking forward, looking to the planning process of some sort. There's an actual resolution on the books that outlines the planning process for the commission, makes it very simple. One of the things that's a real problem is, how do you manage guys like Ted? You know, Ted is a doer.
I don't know. How do you manage Ted? Well, your wife is probably going, how do you manage Ted?
I had 8 years of working to try to figure out how to do that. But I can tell you, SHTF happens,
yes,
and the tsunami is coming over the gunnels, this is the guy you want down on the docks to help you with it. But the reality is you, the commission has to come to grips with what they're going to do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Are we just going to sit here and have a weekly meeting? That's right. Or a monthly meeting or what? And without a plan, you don't first of all have a way to manage your director. Secondly, there's no way to manage what good you guys have done as a commission, you know.
I was really confused when the whole thing started boiling, and Dellinger obviously got kicked out, because it looked like what was happening was that they were going back 2 years trying to find something that was bad.
Well, I think that is the case.
Wrong.
I've had anecdotal
felt silly.
People come to me and say that has happened. People have been asked, staff has been asked to go back and look for any bad things on Ted. I mean, I don't know how to be discreet.
I don't know. I'm not quite sure understand that.
I think the only reason for that is I think that some people felt threatened by Ted's return from Orcas Island into Brookings. Threatened, not physically, but threatened by maybe a competition for public office or for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. It's all worthless.
Mm-hmm.
All of it is a waste of time and a waste of the taxpayers' money.
Right. Well, it can't be undone. Number one, if it's done, right, and it's not like you can go back and undo any. If you wanted to,
well, if we're looking around for somebody to blame for the brand new dock that is working, that is generating $3,000 or $4,000 worth of revenue per month for the port.
I'll take the blame.
Yeah. It actually wasn't my idea. What I do is step up and if I can recognize a good idea. Now, if we go, you know, in order to look at how that dock got there, we can go
back.
We
are talking the BC Fisheries dock.
The dock that actually is a viable dock that wasn't built by unqualified port staff. That's the PAC Choice dock that is condemned. Okay.
Oh.
That was built during the era of, we'll just build it and get away with it any way we can.
Right.
The PAC Choice dock is now condemned because it was not built correctly. It's it's an old dock. It certainly lived for quite a few years, but there are a million reasons why that thing is wrong. It was just built wrong by people who didn't know how to build docks. Well, the BC dock that we got the grant money from the state of Oregon to build was, that was engineered, and it was built according to engineering, but it was also it was originally contemplated as part of, you know, there had been a dock there before.
Mm-hmm.
So way back, we're going to go on back to late 1990s, maybe early 2000, I believe it was 2003, when the port, Jim wasn't on the commission at this time, the port bought that last remaining piece of private property. There was, except for that small piece of underwater property I was telling you about, there was a piece of property that belonged to Eureka Fisheries, which was a fish processing facility that went out of business. It was also, from what I could determine by seeing the wreckage of the place, it was built shoddily and there are many stories about the floor dropping out, different things like that happening.
And while you were there?
No,
that would have been bad.
This is when it was still running. They dropped a forklift through the floor at one point, I heard. So at any rate, it ended up being closed, and the port bought it for $350,000, I believe, with borrowed funds from the state.
Wow.
They borrowed that money. This is one that, so you can see that is a percentage of the $6 million worth of debt. The port bought this ground with the idea that they would build a new fish processing plant on it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I know this because I found the engineering or the proposal for the new fish processing plant that was, it was not viable. They applied for a grant. They got a $400,000 HUD grant after purchasing the property that they were going to use to build the facility. But then things fell apart and they walked away from the project in about 2003. And so the place was, they did go in and tear down the facility and rip out the old dock. Mm-hmm. That's what they did that. Mm-hmm. And so there were some old pilings and there was a lot of junk and people stored crab pots in and around the junk. And that sat idle until about 2014. And I was getting sick of people storing their crab pots there and not paying rent for the ground because mm-hmm. you couldn't keep track of everything. Mm-hmm. So port staff went in and cleaned that up, mm-hmm. removed all the junk, repaired the existing seawall that had been partially destroyed by the demolition of the building, repaired that, got that lot back up into usable condition. When it was like that, the neighbor to the lot, Mike Manning of BC Fisheries, got to looking at it and he wanted to rent it. So first he rented it and he started storing crab pots, his own stuff. He incorporated it into his business. Mm-hmm. Well, then he was noodling around and he came up with the idea of building a fish processing facility, specifically a shrimp facility, because BC Fisheries primarily was in the crab unloading business, crab unloading and selling live crab. But they would also unload any other kind of fish product and they truck it elsewhere. So that business was basically an unloader and a trucking firm. Mm-hmm. They wanted to branch out and go into processing.
Mm-hmm.
So he developed a business proposal. He went out and he sought funding for that proposal. He got it by working with the USDA and with several other groups, got $7 or $8 million worth of funding. Now that funding, that the original plan included reparation of that dock at private expense, okay?
At private expense. That's his expense?
Correct. He would have owned the dock.
Got it.
Okay?
Okay.
So, if somebody else owns the dock, does the port get rent for it? No, they don't. But could the port afford, did the port have any money to rebuild $1.5 million dock? No, because the port doesn't have any money.
Right.
Because they're historically underfunded.
Right.
And they owe a lot of money in debts for things like buying a piece of property in 2003 and leaving it unused and fallow for close to 15 years. So you look at that and you're like, that's not a smart business decision.
Right.
And most businesses that do that go out of business.
Right.
So, but you can see this is where the problems developed.
Right.
Is they, people have ideas, they don't follow through.
Right.
But we go back to the BC Fisheries plan. Now, I heard about the plan. Mike Manning was a port commissioner. He came to the port and he explained what he wanted to do there. The port gave him a vote of confidence, as I recall. There wasn't really much for the port to do at this point because he was already leasing the ground.
We agreed. We signed a letter of intent to leasing ground.
Yeah.
Right.
You might say that, you know, this is another one of my ideas that got shot down. I wanted the port to be a partner
mm-hmm.
with BC Fisheries.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lessor,
right?
To be a partner,
right?
And I couldn't convince Ted of that, the value of that, nor the other commissioner. So we ended up leasing the ground,
mm-hmm.
and that's really the only revenue we get out of that. Right?
That's
now.
The only revenue that we get out of that.
Leased
yes.
property out of it.
So what was but what was the deal with the dock? Didn't there need to be a dock?
So we looked at that.
Okay,
and I said, you know, it's going to be hard. It's We've had quite a bit of experience doing projects where port staff does the work, right?
Mm-hmm.
When, especially in water projects, we've mm-hmm. done dredging, we've built docks, we've done a lot of these things that you have to work with the Corps of Engineers. You have to work with an in-water work period. There are a lot of problems with working over the water that lend themselves to higher costs. The port as a public entity seems to have a little bit more flexibility to get that done. Mm-hmm. At least we had a lot of success with that. So I said, you know, if you're going to be building the dock over the water, you're going to run, since you're a private entity, you're going to run into all kinds of problems because the government is not inclined to work with you. But they are inclined to work with the port because we've already proven we can do it.
Right.
So I propose that we build the dock at port expense if we could come up with the funding.
Okay.
So I went to Salem, took Mike Manning and his business proposal up there, and we met with our legislators. They thought it was a good idea. They got us the money, and the rest is history.
And is that part of the emergency contract thing?
That's, well, so the emergency contract thing was a function of, the money was approved. You know, when you get a legislative, you get the legislature approves a grant in a fiscal year. They approved that in I want to say June of 2015.
Okay.
But the money wouldn't be available until July of 2016.
Oh, wow.
Because of the fiscal year.
Well, you can't wait that long.
Oh, you said it yourself. Doesn't that kind of sound like maybe there might be an emergency in the offing? Since somebody else is already engaged for $8 million worth of financing.
Uh-huh.
Now, if we want to step in and take that one chunk that we can do
right.
with money from the state
right.
and turn that into a revenue-producing asset,
right.
we have to meet the time frame of the person who's running the project, which is building. Mike Manning and BC Fisheries borrowed millions of dollars, and they needed to be in business by the following April 1st, which is the start of shrimp season, okay?
So by doing an emergency contract thing, you
well,
can...
Well, no, I'm not okay. quite through yet.
Not yet.
So,
got
because we know, for one thing, that there's no money available until 2018. Now, if you've ever... I personally have never owed $6 million that I can't make payments on myself.
I've never owed $6 million anyway, but yeah.
but say you owed $6 million and you had really bad credit and you've proven that you couldn't make your payments on time.
Kind
Do you think people
like
would rush out and say, hey, hey, how about we just lend you the money? Well, they just weren't jumping out of the woodwork to do that.
I'm shocked,
so
Ted.
We went to the state and we worked with Infrastructure Finance Authority and we worked out what's called a bridge loan,
okay.
which allowed the money that was promised in 2018 to be loaned by another fund of the state
okay.
that was already existing. But that took time. Just doing all that stuff took us till late November, okay, because we had to jump through all the hoops. We had
right.
we also had to show that we were actually a viable business ourselves, and,
right.
and show that we were doing going in the right direction. We finally get all that done in late November, as I recall, of 2015. Well, you know, you don't hire a contractor without they need to know that you're going to have the money. Well, we didn't know we were going to have the money until we had the bridge loan, so I couldn't really talk to anybody. But during that intervening time, if you recall, Mike Manning had about a year to put up his facility. Construction had already begun on his facility.
Okay.
He had chosen his contractor.
Okay.
Now, all of this stuff needed to be built on the same piece of ground. The dock is adjacent to and
right.
part and actually integral to the land that seawall I told you to, it's incorporated into the seawall, which actually is right in front of where the plant, of where the building went.
Okay.
So in looking at the totality of the circumstances, it was clear that I've had a lot of experience with working with contractors and big projects, and I know, and I'm a construction litigation attorney. I mean, that's what I've done. Where, you know, Tidewater's been my client forever, and I know how these guys work, and I know that they're there to make money.
Right.
So we only had a finite amount of money. We had $1.5 million that was given by the state for this particular purpose. We had to get that built within a specific time frame.
And within
between,
certain money.
Let's think about this for a minute. Between November of 2015 and April 1st of 2016, we had to get that dock usable, okay? So we also had to get it in a way that would not result if you had a time delay resulting in you know from say the contractor you hired says you know I can't work with
right.
these people I can't get around through
right.
here and
right.
this, the way this usually goes that time delay would reflect back on us. We're the
right.
ones that had intervened into the scenario to try to better the port
right.
So we had some pretty stiff constraints to work with. The totality of the circumstances made it clear that it was an emergency situation where we were actually constrained to the contractor who'd been hired by BC Fisheries. We had to work with that person who was luckily qualified to do the work. And of course, the work.
I mean, it seems so clear.
It's very clear. But the interesting thing is, prior to that newspaper article in January, nobody ever asked me about it, and I was there.
And see, that's what I find so bizarre, is that, you know, when you go and take a look at the paperwork, Roy Davis's name is on it, and your name is on it.
All the commissioners.
Why didn't somebody just ask the question?
I don't know.
That's when you start to see ulterior motive.
Yeah,
if you really want information, you know, people
you
are going to ask the question.
Right? So, just ask the person whose name is on the piece of paper. It's bizarre. So where do you think that the port should be? I mean, clearly the whole looking backwards thing is not what we should be doing, right? I mean, we're burning money it's going out of style.
Time would be well spent right now, personally. The time would be well spent to do some quick planning, because you can't budget, and right now is budgeting season, without a plan. What are you going to budget to?
And I think they are actually starting the budgeting process.
So now is the time to do that. And, and the way to do that is to have some consensus amongst the five commissioners of what they would like to get accomplished this fiscal year. Starting right now, starting July 1, for the next 12 months, what you would like the port to get accomplished. Some set of tasks, something that they could come to agreement on, that all that as a port commission, these are what we would like to see happening. Hopefully, it would involve economic development. It would involve.
Well, when you were here before, you talked about the fact that the port should be entrepreneurial and should be generating.
If you look at the tax revenue that comes into the port, it's very, very small compared to other public entities, percentage-wise. We're expected to earn our own way, the port is.
Mm-hmm.
On the same token, because we're entrepreneurial, we should be governed by the same kind of finance rules that govern companies out mm-hmm. here, other entrepreneurial endeavors.
Mm-hmm.
A good example, a good return on assets would be 5% maybe, if we just take 5%, that if we had our assets sitting out here, return on assets of 5% would be acceptable. Okay, well, that means you take your net profit from all your operations, and that should be, net profit should be 5% of what your assets are. Our assets, conservatively, are $15 to $20 million.
Okay.
So 10% of, say, $20 million is $2 million.
Right.
5% would be $1 million in net profit is what we should be making. We generally, I don't know if we've gotten far beyond it, but right now the port, when I left the port, it was doing about $2 million gross per year. And it's probably in that neighborhood still, between $2 to $3 million gross per year. Nowhere near a million net. You know, the port was very, very lucky to ever make, you know, $100,000 profit.
Oh,
okay.
Oh, that's not good.
No. So in order to get to that point, you're going to have to increase revenues one way or the other, or mm-hmm. decrease expense.
Mm-hmm.
The only way we're going to decrease expense meaningfully is going to be to get rid of our debt service,
mm-hmm.
which means we got to pay it off.
Right.
Okay.
But you can't really pay it off if you don't have any money.
But we're all set to.
Not unless you're willing to sell off an asset.
Well, actually, if you recall, Jim, we got the property appraised.
Yeah.
We found a public lender that was going to buy us. They were going to refinance our debt.
The whole thing.
Refinance the whole thing. And a lot, like I told you, all those, there are 13 or 17 different notes, maybe 13.
Right.
I can't remember which it is. And those notes are all at different interest rates from the 80s and the 90s.
Okay.
Okay. Some as high as 7%. Okay.
Oh.
Now, these, you know, in normal business, what we try to, and like at your house,
right.
There you are. You've gotten yourself in over your head. You kept going to the casino when you shouldn't.
And
you,
darn it.
And you maxed out your credit card.
Right.
So first move is you refinance to a lower interest rate.
Exactly.
Okay.
Right.
Simple. The same rules that apply to your house apply to a business.
Absolutely.
And
right.
And they apply to the port as well. Well, so we were all set for that. Now I want to go back and point out that in 2014, I believe it was, maybe a little bit earlier, I think it was 2014, the port entered into the strategic planning process at the direction of the state of Oregon. We did, and we followed their parameters, and we wrestled with it, and we fought, and we argued, and we ended up with a strategic plan that was created by some outside consultants, Berger Abram, that are out of Portland, I believe, and work in Washington and California and Oregon with ports and with other airports, different things like that. We got a good plan. The plan looked at our situation. When Jim is telling you that you need to raise revenue, he doesn't get the credit for that, okay? Because
I'm sorry, Jim.
We paid good money for that.
Right.
Jim told us before we had the study done, of course, but we knew we needed to create new revenue sources to make the port viable. We were directed to do that through the strategic plan, which was adopted by the commission that Jim sat on. They directed me as the manager to go out and start developing new revenue sources. Not just businesses, also look at other revenue streams, one of which was a landing tax that Crescent City has, for example. Other ports up and down the coast do have it. We were in the process of getting it, and we were the local powers that be came in, slammed us down, and said that we weren't entitled to have that revenue stream. So we had to look elsewhere and try to come up with some other ideas. I did come up with another idea, just use what we had at hand. We had, during the tsunami, as part of the FEMA funding, we had been forced to teach our guys how to dredge. We rented a dredge. We learned how to dredge. Well, I convinced the state of Oregon to buy itself a dredge, and we would operate it. So, and that was, that's, this is, I mean, I can only do so much with what we have, right? So they bought a $2 million dredge, got it all set up, Port of Bergen's Harbor operated it. We dredged Bandon, Gold Beach, and then the sinkhole happened, we dredged Brookings. All of those projects made the Port of Bergen's Harbor money, okay?
Was that the Yakina?
No, this is a separate, it's a small dredge that dredges basins. The Yaquina is a federal dredge that only dredges channels. It can't get in and do what we did.
Okay.
It can't handle, so anyway, So that was a revenue source that was developed by and for the Port of Bergen's Harbor that was financed by the state. Now, when I left, within 2 weeks, that was taken away from the Port of Bergen's Harbor.
Wow!
And I'll admit that the sitting commission at that time did not seem to value that as a potential. They wanted to look elsewhere for their revenue, which they did by raising lease rates. And, you know, these are, but in fact, those, you know, these are issues. We needed more revenue, not less. We didn't,
right.
Like we didn't need, it's unfortunate that the laundromat was torn down. I've always said the way that you run your household, it's the way you run your business. A lot of little things add up to success, not just one big thing. Right. We're going to borrow $20 million and it's going to be great.
Right.
That never works.
No.
So, no. So that's when I see a thing like a $27 million grant coming right now, I will tell you the public here will think, they read that headline, they think, oh, problem solved, which is really, I think, the thing that is at the heart of our problem with our port. You see, the people who are affected by the port in our community don't know how important it is to them. I mean, and when I'm not talking about the fishermen, I'm talking about everybody in this town. We have a couple of things that bring revenue into this town in a big way. One of them is South Coast Lumber. One of them is our port. If we don't have those two things, we're just kind of an inert place where some retired people live. And you need new money coming in to keep things going.
Right.
And the port itself, if you look at the amount of money that is brought in by crab season alone, it's a huge, huge thing. You can tell crab season starts a month late. It's bad. People are out of money. They don't have any money, and it reflects across the whole community.
That's right.
That's why this stuff is important. So during, it's, you look at how to make the port profitable. And one way you can do that is to make the users pay. a higher rate. And that's one possibility.
Right.
The problem is that when you're looking at the viability of that doesn't work so well when you've got competing ports on either side of you that are offering moorage for lower rates and, right. and perhaps aren't operating themselves with the fiscal responsibility necessary to keep right. their, if, you know, I was often told when I said, we're going to charge this for ice, they said, we'll just get our ice in Charleston. Well, I can't compete with Charleston because Charleston gets federal funds, state funds, whenever they want it. It's not a real business. Okay.
Right, right.
But I was forced to try to balance the books myself. Okay. Wasn't getting state funds, wasn't getting federal funds. That's a good example of how, but when your competition is government subsidized, or say, for example, Crescent City, they somehow decided it was a great idea to invest $45 million after the tsunami hit them, and they borrowed a lot of money. You may have heard just here recently, they're starting a Save the Port group down there because she's going, yeah. well, we'll say belly up.
Yeah. yeah. But this is also where things like the RV park come in, because if, like you were saying the last time we talked, Jim, if that RV park was really kept up and was an attractive place, that would be,
could be a huge cash
cow.
We found that every, even what we did, a revamp of the RV park a couple of years ago, to the extent we could with cash we had on hand, we spent $30,000+. That translated into revenue jumping 30%.
Yeah. Wow.
It
was,
doesn't now, take much.
No.
Now, and if you were
put if you put good restrooms, nice clean restrooms, have a laundry facility there, mm-hmm. get the traffic flow cleaned up,
mm-hmm. Get a little Wi-Fi there.
It could mm-hmm. be. It could be. It has always been a cash cow for mm-hmm. the port, but it could really be a profitable operation. It's that part of the problem I think we run into is the budget itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Ports are different. We have to be entrepreneurial. We need to be thinking of strategic planning,
mm-hmm.
not budgeting. Budgeting is a part of planning, but the
yeah,
port has to fill out.
That's interesting because it feels like it's backwards right now.
The interesting yeah. element, and I know you're running out of time here, but the interesting element is the forms that need to be filled out
mm-hmm.
to send into the state on your budget are called the LBL forms, and there's about six of them. And they've been around as long as I've been here, 25 years. And what they are is they promote listless, lazy thinking. And mm-hmm. here's the reason.
Mm-hmm.
The form sits here, and on this left-hand side is 2 years ago's budget.
Mm-hmm.
The next column over is last year's budget.
Mm-hmm.
The middle column is what you expect this year's budget to be. Okay, and then the next column is what you're expecting next year's budget to be. So the idea there is that it's just a percentage increase.
Ah.
We start with a labor cost of $100,000. We're just going to increase that by 10%.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, what do lay people know about budgeting?
Right.
And we're all lay people.
Right, right.
Ted's the professional.
Right.
He's the executive director. He's the professional. You know, the rest of us are just lay people. We don't know, you know, the ins and outs of it. Budgeting should always respond to a plan. What are we going to do and how much are we going to spend doing it? And if we haven't got a plan, then we better figure out what we're spending the money for.
And theoretically, that's what the commissioners should be doing,
that's
right?
That's what their job is.
Yeah.
Even a bad plan is better than no plan at all.
Right.
Their job, and we will fail. They will fail. You know, that's the nature of
you make mistakes.
Right, of course.
That's their job, is to come up with the direction that the port should be going in. You've got the largest single political subdivision outside the county that's a part of your district. You're just as responsible for economic development on Carpenterville Road as you are on this 40 acres that are right down here at the port. Maybe we should have a filling station. You know, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we should have a storage unit. You know, 25 units.
But definitely start looking outside.
If you look, around at how other ports work, other ports in Washington, I was able to work up in Washington with a lot of great people, and their whole approach to public ports is a little bit more kind of advanced than what we have here in Oregon. And but there are a lot of good stuff going on in Oregon too. You'll have a port. You know, you don't have to have water to have a port. You can have an airport. You can have all different things. But you'll find them doing all kinds of stuff. They do. all kinds of property development to bring in economic development, and it, you can see it working if people are committed to using the tools that port districts are given through the enabling statute, which right. is 777 here in Oregon. And
it does mean that you have to have that ability to kind of imagine a future, right?
Not really. All you got to do is ask the question.
Okay.
No,
but you'd have to ask the right question to the right person, right?
The question of us as a board. Okay, what do you want me to do next year?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's a very valid question. Mm-hmm. You know, he can come in and say, I recommend that we do this because it falls into line with things that we've done in the past, mm-hmm. and we're doing this. These are the reasons for doing it. Whatever, but there needs to be an articulated goal. What do we want to do? It can be a financial goal. We want to see $700,000 in free cash in the bank on December 31st. That's a goal.
Absolutely. Okay. And then you can make a plan that follows.
Okay, then to right. get there, you're going to need right. $220,000 a quarter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're going to set up a quarterly goal of net 220, and we're going to keep the executive director his feet to the fire every quarter
right.
based on how he's been able to do that.
Right.
Okay, at the end of the year, you're going to see if you made your goal or not.
Right.
Now, that's overly simplistic, but not really.
Right.
All you got to do is ask the question and then develop the tools. How are you going to do it?
Right, right.
That's why you have the professionals. When Jan Barbas says, well, I got involved and the board got involved with putting this grant together, that really makes me nervous because Jan Barbas has no clue how to do that. That's for the pros.
Well, in fact, there was a pro involved in that. It was Jack Aiken, the engineer who, I didn't hire him, Russ Crabtree hired him. And
he's been around forever.
He's been around forever, wow. And he knows the port backwards and forwards. So that's who you use,
mm-hmm.
and he has the tools and the expertise to develop it. And let's face it, the rest of us aren't all experts in everything. You know, I mean, we just have to. You find the people that can help you with these things, and they're out there. For example, when we talk about the development of this of the issue with the BC Fisheries Dock, there were some questions that were somehow referred to the district attorney without asking any questions whatsoever. It might have been helpful, you know. I got the impression that people were saying that I wrote the contract, that I developed the plan. I'm an attorney. I could do that, but you need to pay me to do it. I don't do that for the Port of Brookings Harbor.
Right.
I was the manager there of the business.
Right.
That's what I was very clear that I would never provide a legal opinion for the Port of Brookings Harbor while I was the manager, and I never did, and I never performed other legal work. I used the form leases that they had. I used uh-huh. everything that we had on hand uh-huh. there. But in this case, we hired a consultant who came in, put that package together for us. I think we paid something like $25,000 to have it done. But it was done right. And it was, here's how I know it was done right. This is why I'm having trouble understanding why people are looking back. Because there's an existing dock that I delivered crab over all season myself, along with a lot of other boats. They're operating cranes. It's a big, safe facility, which is in short supply down at the Port of Brookings Harbor. And we're moving in the right direction. And that thing generates thousands of dollars a month directly into the port coffers now, because we were able to get a grant from the state, hire a consultant to put the project together. And he's the one who also wrote the grant application as well. He did it. And so money well spent, I say.
Yeah.
We get it done. And now we move forward. And what the port needs is some more projects like that.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been great if we could have followed up and we were all set to refinance that debt away. That would have given us some working capital where we could proceed and make planning choices and budget according to having some freeboard available. But in this case, we had, you know, at that point, I got to tell you, I was ready to leave the Port of Brookings Harbor, and I did.
You know, it's funny because so many of us are volunteers. I mean, there certainly are some people that actually get paid, which is fabulous. But the personalities are just, I mean, that's where the minefields are. Mm-hmm. People decide that they don't like that person. So because they don't like that person, then they're not going to agree with anything that they want to do. And it just seems so foolish.
That attitude is very real. I mean, it manifests itself in the way port meetings are managed. Mm-hmm. And it's been a pet peeve of mine for a long time that's why you have Robert's rules.
Right.
So you don't have to take into account personalities.
Right. Right.
There's a way to get business accomplished,
exactly.
Even amongst adamant enemies.
Exactly.
You can get it accomplished.
Right.
But not unless, it won't happen unless you manage the meeting well.
Yes. Yes.
Well, if you're going to be entrepreneurial, you got to think the Port Commission needs to be thinking of themselves as a board of directors.
Yes, and which means you don't stick your finger in every little pie.
If you do, it's a recipe for disaster.
Exactly, exactly.
So you give your director specific goals, and then you monitor his performance, and you pay him well when he does well.
Right. So, all right, it looks to me like we are getting very close to the end. I don't know where these hours go. Every time we do that, it feels like they just evaporate. Do either one of you have any last sentiment or last thing that you want to say? I mean, obviously there's so much misinformation going around out there.
Just a few things. You had presented both Ted and me with a series of questions that you had received, and it's very clear to me reading the questions that either the folks that are asking the questions don't know the time frames, they don't know, and the questions are very accusatory in the way they're phrased. Many of the questions that you've asked me, I don't have an answer for because I wasn't here. Mm-hmm. My term went from 2007 to 2015, May of 2015. So that's when I was in office. I have not been to a port meeting since May of 2015. So the questions about that I was on the board when these nefarious contracts were done obviously are not true because I wasn't there.
Right.
And there's a lot of questions that were asked of Ted that he's already answered a number of times.
Right.
And so, I left in May of 2016.
So, okay. Again, we're spending our time looking backwards.
Right,
so,
which is just not.
To me, that's a waste of time.
All right, we are definitely out of time at this point. So maybe I can have you both come back at some point,
Whenever.
And we can keep talking. But I really want to thank you both for coming in because I think that there's so much misinformation out there, and I really appreciate you trying to clear something up for us. So thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
And thank you for listening and making KCIW your community radio station. This has been Our Community with guests today, Jim Rutherford and Ted Fitzgerald. Podcasts of our shows can be accessed on our website, kciw.org. See you around the community.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.